and open a work session on HJM 4. Where's the one that says who's carrying it? There we go. Well,
I gave it to you.
I think it might be Merrick Berry.
No, is it? Did you give me it? There it is. Okay. Representative's carrying it. Representative Gelser's carrying it, who's not here today. So why don't I carry it? Sandy, would you tell us about HJM 4?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, HJM 4 comes to you from the Subcommittee on Health Policy, had a public hearing on the 17th. We had a 4-1 vote on that. This one, the memorial expresses support for participation by Taiwan in the World Health Organization. The subcommittee had a presentation from a representative from the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office from Seattle. It was a PowerPoint presentation and covered the current population, and which is 23 million citizens and 400,000 foreign nationals, why it's important to Taiwan for them to be a part of the partnership of the World Health Organization, and that they also outlined their commitment to continually bid, to continue to participate, and hopefully eventually become officially included in the World Health Organization. And Mr. Chair, fill in any gaps.
Okay, the basic discussion we had to do with why it's important for a state to be a member of the World Health Organization. And the importance is that it facilitates the ability of outside communities to help individual states in the times of an epidemic. For example, a SARS epidemic that was very dangerous in Taiwan. The key point for our perspective is there are tens of thousands of visitors a year that go to Taiwan and come back, and Taiwan's ability to protect the traveler is really facilitated by their ability to work in this supposedly non-political environment of the World Health Organization. Turns out it's not exactly always non-political, but that's a discussion for a different day. They've been kept out because of the problem that the People's Republic of China views Taiwan as a part of the PRC. The Taiwanese don't necessarily consider them a part of the PRC, even though in practical terms they have very close relationships and trade and do a variety of other things, but it's this symbolic and political relationship. The subcommittee felt this was a legitimate request, and I'm open to a motion on HJM 4, so we can open up the discussion on it.
Mr. Chair?
I
would move House Joint Memorial 4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Move it to the floor with a due adopt recommendation.
All right. Is there any discussion of HJM 4?
Mr. Chair? I would just say that in the presentation that we received, that this isn't the first time the legislature has seen this, but that it has had some effect along with other states' resolutions because there has been a thawing effect in terms of World Health Organization involvement in Taiwan. So I would urge us to do this again. Couldn't do nothing but help.
Right. Is there any other discussion? Aaron, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Bowley.
Aye.
Representative
Berlin. Aye.
Representative Kim.
Aye.
Representative Flora.
Aye.
Representative Gilson.
Excused.
Representative
Towns. Aye.
Vice Chair
Clinton. Aye. Excused. Aye. HJM passes and it will move to the floor. You took up Representative Gelser. Is there a reason for that? Oh.
Only because this was the SMS from the subcommittee.
Should I carry it? Can I ask Representative Gelser?
I'd be happy to.
Okay. Can
check with
Representative Gelser. Is this Butler's recommendation?
Yes. Correct. It is. It is at Representative Butler's.
Let's ask Representative Butler.
Okay. Okay.
That would be great.
Okay.
That's a good idea, Sandy. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, we have some written testimony attached in your packet too that you folks can please. We just want to acknowledge for the record in support of the memorial, so we can exhibit it for the record,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair. It is from Peter Coyle.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the work session on HJM 4. There are There are three bills, 3057, 3058, and 3059, that we would like to move all to revenue without a recommendation. We actually didn't hear the substance of those bills in the subcommittee. We think the proper place for them to be is in revenue. We think there are a variety of other provider tax bills in revenue, and I would be happy to have a motion to move HB 3057, 3058, and 3059 to the Revenue Committee without recommendation. I'm sorry, whoops. Open a work session on HB 3057, 3058, and 3059. Madam Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3057, 3058, and 3059 to the Revenue Committee without a recommendation.
Is there any discussion on those three bills? Clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. How about if you just announce that those two are excused on each of these bills? That'll be just fine. Skip over to this. I was going to skip over 3017 and 3092 for a moment and go right to open a work session on HB 3089. One of my constituents asked that we handle that early and so he could go home early on a Friday afternoon, and always being attuned to constituent service. I did open a work session on HB 3089. Representative Bonamici, will you carry that bill to us?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to us at the request of the Oregon Acupuncture Association, and their concern was that there are some of their students who are attending College of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine who are graduating with a doctorate degree and are under current statute it's not clear that they can use the title doctor. And so we did start out our discussion with an interesting perspective from Representative Clem about the use of the term Oriental and how that maybe culturally insensitive. However, we could not address that issue because the school is actually called, has Oriental in the title, the National College of Naturopathic Medicine and the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine, both of which are in Portland. And the Accreditation Commission has accredited those schools under those names, so we couldn't address that issue. We ended up with a bill, which is the -2 amendment, that adds to the list. It's the list in statute of who can use the term doctor, and it simply adds to the existing language. The existing language was, in the case of a person practicing acupuncture, the word acupuncturist. And in this bill, this amendment simply adds the language, and in the case of a person who has completed a program that leads to a doctoral degree in Oriental medicine and acupuncture from a school that has federally recognized accreditation, the words Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. So we ended up with, in the -2 amendments, with a simple remedy of allowing anyone who receives that doctorate degree to use the title Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine.
Thank you very much. Do you have a motion, Representative Bonamici?
I do, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the -2 amendments to House Bill 3089.
Is there any discussion on the -2 amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It's not clear to me why we have to follow the name. This goes back to Representative Clem's concern. Why we have to follow the name of the college in the title that we give to graduates.
No, it isn't the name of the college we're following. It's the name of the degree we're following.
It's the name of the degree.
Oh, I see.
That's the doctor. That's the degree they're getting, a doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine.
In the system.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And, yeah, what we've done so far is we said, all right, if you have an earned degree and it's a doctorate And you're in the healthcare field, you ought to be able to use the document you have.
Right, and Mr. Chair, it would have been simply beyond what we could do in the Oregon legislature to change that title of that degree, because that's part of what the school offers.
Actually, I'll also add an initial comment. When the president of the University of Oregon got chastised by referring to students as Oriental students in very complimentary terms, and they really had a sort of rebellion pointing out that the current standard is to use the term Asians when it's referring to people, that Oriental refers to rugs and furniture and objects. It seems to me that in this case we're talking about Oriental medicine, which is the traditional term for it, although it's probably really Chinese medicine and not Oriental medicine. It seems to me a little less offensive, but I think following in the tradition of this craziness that people can only be called doctor on the basis of the degree they have, this seems legitimate use.
Thank you, Dr. Greenman.
I always use doctor instead of representative when I'm trying to get a restaurant reservation.
And Mr. Chair, the national accreditation, that's, you know, it's even the national body is like, yes, we know it's a problem, but that's what our name is right now.
I was helping Dr. Maurer understand that, Dr. Maurer, how important it is to use it when you're trying to make a restaurant reservation. And he and I on this committee represent a paradox.
Yes, and I agree.
In many ways. Are there any other discussion on the Dash 2s? Are there any objections to adopting the Dash 2s? Dash 2s are adopted. Do we have another motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3089 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Karen, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 House Bill 3089 is passed, and definitely. Let's put this on the consent calendar if there's no objection. We need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we place House Bill 3089 on the consent calendar.
Is there any discussion of that motion? Aaron? We don't need it? Okay. No objection. The bill will be placed on the consent calendar. Let me take a moment while we have as many members of the committee as we're going to have today to talk about a particular issue. I want to talk about it again on Monday. But I'd like to give you all a chance to think about it, and I apologize that I haven't had a chance to talk to my vice chairs about it. I've been pondering the question of the relationship between our subcommittees and the full committees. And I'm particularly worried about the month of May, where I expect we'll have maybe 50 or so Senate bills to be hearing that will all have to be heard and acted on by the end of the month. The problems in working with the two subcommittee models we've been doing is that on controversial issues, let me say first, the theory is that if you have subcommittees that fully work and make recommendations to the full committees, generally speaking, it will be a sort of pro forma discussion in the full committee, but we'll assume that the work has already been done in the subcommittee, and it's sort of like it is on the committee relationship to the House. The assumption is you do most of the hard work in the committee, and then it goes to the House floor. And sometimes that works, and sometimes that doesn't work. But there are various models I thought we might do. And, of course, one model would be to try and figure out how to meet, say, 3 days a week in the full committee and not meet at all in subcommittees, where we could probably do most of the work. We assume many of the Senate bills will be pre-prepped, and we won't have a lot of ones that are sort of not going to move anyway, although some of them might. We could try and switch to 3 days a week in full committees. That has scheduling problems because not everybody on the committee can make Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, it turns out. There's at least one person that has problems with either of those schedules. We could perhaps move one of them into a night meeting so we could meet Monday, Tuesday night and Friday or something like that. We could ask members of the opposite subcommittee to pay close attention to the schedules and to join us when we're going to hear a bill that they have particular interest in. We can do that. And we are making all the testimony available to all the members of the committee after subcommittee hearing. We've already decided on that, so at least there'll be information. We could do something almost like a consent calendar where anything that came out of a subcommittee unanimously, we would basically have a very brief work session on it in the full committee, unless somebody asked for a full or hearing, by looking at what's come out, and then only expect to have longer hearings on those items that appear to have some contention in them. But somewhere along the line, I think we have to do something to make sure we can get through. We're probably only going to be having the joy of meeting with each other until the end of May, but I'm worried about our ability to do our job and to give legitimate attention to the bills that are going to need attention. So I just wanted to alert you to this. I do want to put a little time on Monday's schedule to talk about this at the beginning of the session. I'll try and brief the two folks who aren't here today, so they may have a chance to think about it as well. Or we can just sort of blunder along. We've done all right, but we've had 3 months to deal with the workload we've had now. Then we're going to have 1 month to work with the Senate bill. How many do we have already?
Senate bills, Mr.
Chairman? Yeah.
32.
And I expect probably at least that much more. They're probably working like we are, trying to pump things out in the last month. Senator Bonamici, you look like you're...
Oh, no, I was just thinking okay. It's a good thing we didn't pass that cloning ban. We could clone ourselves and be in two places at once.
Yeah, well, I think it would have to be for the legislature of 2060 before that would make much difference. Anyway.
Well, if we can't find a time to all meet together, all we can do is watch the agendas and try to get to the meetings that we can. I can't think of another solution because I don't think that there's a time. I mean, I'd prefer to just have three meetings a week. And that'd be great if they were on my days, but that's I don't think the people on the Access Committee are free during that period of time.
You're on how many committees?
Four.
Yeah, that makes it very hard to try and schedule things in a different way for you. All right, I'll re-raise it on Monday. If you have a chance to think about it, you want to talk to me before if you have some suggestions. If not, we can just move ahead and trust we'll get our job done. But okay, where are we now? Okay. Let's go down the list now. I'll open a work session on HB 3092, and I'm the carrier. This comes to us from the Access Committee. Sandy, would you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, HB 3092 came to the subcommittee at the request of, actually it was a committee bill on behalf of Lane Shetterly at the request of the Oregon delegation of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, and he proposed this bill to start moving Oregon towards a more uniform policy approach on the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. And as you can see, the subcommittee heard testimony on some amendments that the subcommittee did adopt. We talked about the donor registration, the registries, the role of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, the current membership of that commission, the need to align Oregon with current federal law and other states in the direction that they're moving, as well as, you know, keeping them current with the technology and the advanced medical directives that are coming down the line. We talked about the Oregon donation process and technical topics in general as it relates to the anatomical gift laws that are on the books.
And this came to us from the policy committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it did.
The policy subcommittee.
Yes, four ayes and one excused.
Madam Vice Chair, do you have any comments on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that we heard consistent and uniform support for adopting these changes, both from the transplant bank, from the donor registry, also from, I believe, the state medical examiner's office. There's some really excellent portions in here in terms of clarifying the rules around organ donation, and this is a really good bill. It's very much needed, and we actually put Oregon out in the forefront of implementing these, or at least putting them into state statute. So I think I didn't see any concerns, and when Representative Shetterly came and described the different aspects, there were no concerns, really, from the committee. It's a good bill.
And there was no opposition.
No opposition.
We will have another bill, a bill by Representative Cannon, before this month ends, on developing a task force on a particular set of issues in anatomical gifts that's not really covered by these. But this is this uniform commission deals with all sorts of complicated issues, and this is one of them. So it seems that this is a good bill. Are there any? Let's see. Do we have a motion,
Mr. Chair? I would move House Bill 3092A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That's right. It had two sets of amendments, the dash ones and the dash two, and they're incorporated.
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, too, you have a dash three amendment in your packet,
oops,
which are they are the ones and the two combined.
If we wanted to do it, yeah.
Right, but I mean, we've already taken action on the ones, but council were able to turn it around in time, so we've got it in one document in front of us.
Well, let's just go with the dash ones and dash twos. Is there any discussion? Hearing?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. HB 3092 is approved to be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This is obviously too complicated to put on the consent calendar. So one of us is going to have to try and explain it to the floor.
Do you want me to carry it?
Yeah, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to.
You might talk to some people in advance.
I will do that. I will write a script on this.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Good leadership role. I was afraid I was going to have to take it. I'll close the work session on HB 3092 and open a work session on HB 3017. Comes to us from the Policy Committee. Sandy, would you comment on it? And then we'll ask Representative Kotek, who's our curator, to make any other comments.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, since the Policy Committee took action on this bill on the 17th, in fact, actually this site issue didn't arise until about 10 to noon today. We're if the committee so is acceptable to carry this over until next Friday, the 27th, the Board of Dentistry just wants to add this language to their exemption statute so that we've got it covered on both ends, wherever this new language lands, but it doesn't in any way conflict with the Dental Act. So we need another amendment.
But they don't have a substantive problem with it.
No, not at all. They have no problem with it. They just want to make sure that the language shows up in all the appropriate places. Obviously, with the timeliness of this issue, we were not able to get a new amendment for our consideration. So we'd like to just carry it over to the full on next Friday.
Does that work for you?
Mr. Chair, it does. And if I just might add, for the folks on the other subcommittee, we heard this bill quite a few weeks ago. It was an attempt to figure out how we could provide some permissive language for folks to get trained to apply fluoride varnish, which is not a technical skill necessarily. It's essentially fluoride on the swab. And so this issue was brought to us. We amended it with the dash ones to just clean it up and make it much simpler. And but there was a question about where this new language actually goes. So I think we do need to wait to make that clarification from the Board of Dentistry. And but this is a very straightforward bill. We can talk about it more. But I would agree of moving it to the next one. Friday, if that is the committee's wish.
Great.
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on HB 3017 and open a work session on HB 3096. Madam Administrator, will you fill us in on 3096?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 3096 was introduced at the request of our Committee on Health Care. It modifies the requirements for licensure of a denturist. We had a public hearing in the Health Access Committee on April 2nd, and then we had it scheduled again on the 16th. This requires the Oregon Health Licensing Agency to issue a license to the denturist to submit proof of meeting requirements, and it specifies specific ways of doing that. It also allows the agency to issue the Oregon denturist license, a license to someone who has submitted the appropriate fees and meets the educational requirements from the District of Columbia and or Canada, other territories of the United States. And it does some other technical aspects. There are no amendments to this bill. There's no revenue. And I haven't received any fiscal impact, but we don't anticipate any.
And there was no opposition to it?
Mr. Chair, there was no opposition.
Yeah, it simply cleans up the language of the Denturist Licensing Act and allows for reciprocity from two jurisdictions that have stronger regulations for licensure than ours does, and the board seemed to have no problem with it. And we didn't get much evidence that there's a huge dramatic shortage of dentures in the state, but the dentures seem to be asking for more competition, and that seems like an okay thing to happen. Are there any questions before we get a motion on it? Or let's get a motion on it, and then we'll open for discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3096 to the floor with a few pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on House Bill 3096? Aaron, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. HB 3096 is moved to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Oh, yeah, that would be great. How about a motion to move that to the consent calendar?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3096 to the consent calendar.
Thank you very much. Is there any objection to that motion? So moved. HB 3096 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be placed on the consent calendar. Okay, wow. Maybe we can do everything in May. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3099. I've asked three people to provide testimony for us today. I don't intend to move this bill today. Okay. Did I open a work session?
No, you didn't.
I didn't. I opened a work session on HB 3099. I don't intend to work this bill today. We do have some time, and I've asked three people to come to us specifically to answer three questions that were raised in the testimony. One question was asked by Representative Gelzer, who's not here to hear the answer, but you can get it on the record. And her question was as a resident of a town that has long since had fluoridation, she asked the State Health Division if there was any evidence that folks who lived in Oregon cities that had fluoridation were in any way health hazarded by doing that. And I've asked Mal Cohn, the state's chief epidemiologist, to talk about that. Anything else he would like to? So, second question had to do with some of the scientific studies that were presented, and there were some questions about the extent to which they had been validated in other ways. And I've asked Dr. Donald Austin from the Department of Public Health Preventive Medicine and the Medical School at OHSU talk about that. And then there were questions about how fluoride gets in the water, what the process is, what kind of materials are used, and what the safeguards are. And we didn't get a very clear answer to that. And I've asked Gail Shibley to talk to us about that process. It looks like we will have some time, so if there's some public testimony that at least a few folks would like to present, could we put out a...
it is your privilege, yeah, Mr. Chair.
Let's put out a temporary sign-up sheet, and if we can have a few folks. The opposition to this bill have not been specifically asked to testify, so this is not formal testimony. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a procedural question?
Yeah, you sure can.
If you're calling people to testify and there's no works, then we're not going to move session. The bill. Yeah, I'm just curious about why it was noticed only as a work session, so that the public didn't have any notice that it was going to be testimony. It sounds like a public hearing to me, not a work session.
You're right, and I've talked to some committee members who are in our position. I promised if after we hear the testimony tonight, there's still a sense that we need to have some formal opposition presentation. We'll open that up on Monday to do that, also in a work session. But since we have enough time and there are people here, I thought we might create a quasi public hearing if there are some folks who want to talk to us. But
thank you, Mr.
this
Chair.
Is not considered. I mean, we are. My intention was to hear those three people, but some of you may have received some email on the other side of that as well.
Well, I'm just concerned about, because it was only noticed as a work session, where do you cross the line between what's a work session and what's a public?
Well, within a work session, you can call anybody you want. And we will have, if we want, and I'll listen to my committee members, another work session. We are carrying this over to Monday. And we'll ask some specific other people to write some testimony on Monday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, I had a conversation with the chair about, since we had so many questions from the committee in the hearing in the subcommittee, I thought it would be helpful to have, to the fullest extent possible, expert testimony to address some of those and try to find some folks not in either camp as a starting point for the next conversation, so hence the invited testimony. But we might need additional testimony on top of that, but that was the intent, at least, to get started for the next conversation, so hence the work session.
Right, and we do need to, we have a packet and testimony and support, and a small packet and testimony and opposition, four pieces in the packet of support, and 54 pieces in testimony and opposition. And we will identify. We will accept those for the record. And in fact, it looks like there are four pieces, but there are only three people. And we'll, those will be distributed to the whole committee.
And they should have a list. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Can I call forward Dr. Mel Cohn, Dr. Don Austin, and Gail Shibley? Thank you all for coming up from Portland today, down from Portland today. Dr. Cohn, we've been seeing a lot of you lately on this committee.
Good. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn, although apparently you know who I am, state epidemiologist from the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I do very much appreciate the attention that you all have given to many important public health issues, so thank you for your time and attention on that, this one included. Dr. Greenlick had asked me to comment on Representative Gelser's question, which, as it got transmitted to me, was... a question about rates of cancer in Corvallis, where there has been fluoridation for quite some time. We do have the state cancer registry, which is in my office, and I'm quite sure we get very good reporting on all of the cases of cancer that occur in the state. And so we were able to go back and look and see the particular kind of cancer for which there's been some discussion about whether or not it's related to fluoride is osteosarcoma, particularly in young males. So what I did was to ask staff to look at osteosarcoma rates in Corvallis and see if they were elevated. They were not. The way that we typically do this is we compare this to an expected rate that's based on the overall rate for the state. Given the population of Corvallis, how many cases would we expect to see? And the rate was essentially the same as what we see in the state. In fact, I think it was slightly less than that. We did a similar analysis for Salem, where there is also fluoridated water, and had very similar results. So from my perspective, I don't think we have any evidence that there's any kind of problems with osteosarcoma in the state that track with any sort of pattern of fluoride use. I will say that I'm in the business of outbreak investigation and disease detection. Nothing gets my, you may think I'm a very strange person, but nothing gets my juices flowing more than having a problem like this to work on and hopefully solve. So if we had outbreaks like this or investigations like this, I would be very eager to pursue them and make whatever policy or other recommendations that needed to be made to solve them. That's what we do every day, and that's why we do what we do. So I wanted to add that as well, that we have not had any outbreak investigations or disease cluster investigations that I'm aware of in my now 9 years at the Public Health Division that have tracked back to fluoride in any way. Recently, I did have a question raised about this by an anti-fluoride activist with regard to a cancer cluster in Troutdale, and we looked into that further, and actually, it turned out not to be a cluster at all, which is something that frequently happens with these kinds of things. When you look at the actual kinds of disease and what's involved, it often turns out what first appeared to be a cluster turns out not to be one. So that's basically what I had to say in response to Representative Gelser's questions.
Mr. Chair, it's good to see you, Dr. Cohn. Are you aware, I'm just curious because as you were talking, any other place in the United States that might have stopped doing community water fluoridation based on some elevated health risks that you're aware of, that they would have stopped doing it?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, no, I am not. You know, from my perspective, looking at the science of this, I think this is about as good as the data ever get, showing that this is safe and effective. We may quibble about how effective it actually is. I think there's some legitimate scientific debate about that, but again, I think that would be universally the stand of my colleagues in public health around the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Cohn, for being here. You're talking about fluoride being safe and effective. Then can you explain the ADA warning about not mixing it with baby formula and also why there's the warning on the toothpaste tube?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bonamici. Absolutely. Fluoride, just like any other substance when taken at high levels, is problematic. For that matter, table salt is problematic if taken at too high levels. And the issues with, I'm trained as a pediatrician, the issues with baby formula and fluoridated water are ones that we have dealt with in communities where fluoride is already in the water very effectively for years. So I don't mean to say that under no circumstances is there ever a problem with fluoride. Of course, at high doses, there is a problem, and that needs to be dealt with appropriately.
So?
Yes, follow up.
Just keep going.
Yeah, I'm concerned then about the fact that we can't, there's no way for us to know how much water children will be drinking. Well, anyone for that matter, but particularly children. And in one of the earlier public hearings, I asked a question about how many glasses of water would a child need to drink in order to get the amount of fluoride that's in a pea-sized amount of toothpaste, which is what is recommended children use, but not swallow. And the answer was about 2 glasses. But obviously, people, and especially children, drink various amounts of water. Kids who play sports will drink more water. Kids who don't will drink a little bit. So if we can't control how much water they're drinking, therefore we can't control how much fluoride they're getting if the water's fluoridated. So I'm just struggling with how we can address that issue when we can't control the dose.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, again, I think experience has taught us that this is a very small problem around the country where this has been an issue. In addition, the kinds of things that people are concerned about with too much fluoride for young children, and it's particularly the young children that we're concerned about. It's generally not the folks who are playing sports and drinking water and so forth, but the young infants, is fluorosis of the teeth, and which is a cosmetic problem, essentially. So, you know, you have to weigh the risk of that, which I think experience has taught us is quite small compared with all of the issues with dental caries and dental health, which I think are very, very serious ones that we're dealing with.
Can I ask another one?
You can keep going.
Thank you. There's also been some difference of opinion about...
Dr. Austin, why don't you introduce yourself, and if you'd like to join in this conversation at any point, please feel free.
Thank you. Well, he's answering all the questions. That's great.
The benefits of fluoride being topical rather than systemic, and I wondered your opinion about that, because if the benefit is primarily topical, then shouldn't we be spending our resources trying to expand health care for children, dental care for children, getting fluoride onto the teeth of children rather than in the water of people who don't necessarily want it in their water?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Bonamici. Excuse me, Chair Representative Bonamici. It's true that the fluoride applied to the teeth surfaces is an important modality for dental health, but one is not a substitute really for the other. You know, again, experience has shown around the country with fluoride in the water that this is a very effective way to improve dental health, and that's really what we're after with this. Although I certainly do agree, it's not an either-or. We should be expanding dental access to dental care, and we should be expanding access to health care as well. Those are very important things to do also.
Thank you.
And actually, we get universal access and not pass the bill. I'm with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please down here speak up if you have a question.
I just been wanting to ask. The topical issue is in the water. That makes it topical as well, doesn't it? With someone drinking, I mean, it's touching your teeth. It's topical. Am I getting that right?
Representative Chair Greenlake, Representative Kotek, absolutely. Okay. That's true.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Austin?
Thank you. My name is Donald Austin, and I'm a professor in the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine. I'm a physician board certified in preventive medicine, and I'm also here representing the Oregon Public Health Association today. I am a member both
father
of the
Oregon Cancer Registry.
Pardon me?
Also the father of the Oregon Cancer Registry.
That's true also, yes. I'm also on the board of directors of the Oregon Public Health Association on the policy committee. I can make a couple of statements that I'd like to make.
I would like you to stick in your testimony to the questions of the scientific.
Thank you. And I have to admit that a specific question did not get forwarded to me. What I was asked to do, the way I understood it, was to try to respond to the scientific rationale for fluoridation. And I'm happy to do that. I have a couple of documents that's being passed around. And I want to point out that when when fluoridation was first tried in Grand Rapids, Michigan, they tried it for 11 years, and within 11 years, it decreased the prevalence of dental caries by over 60%. And we don't see that today. Today, the percent is mostly 18 to about 40%. And the reason for that is because we know it's protective and people are getting fluoride in other ways. At that time, they weren't. And there's also some spillover from places that do have fluoride to places that don't. People go out to have vacations in other towns or play basketball games or whatever, and the whole family goes and they get some fluoride from other places. Fluoridation of community water has been used successfully to prevent caries for over 60 years. In over two-thirds of this country, foreign countries, and administered correctly, it is safe and effective. The complication of the usual complication of overdose is dental fluorosis. And I've included in the handout, if you have them, is some pictures of fluorosis showing what severe fluorosis is, what mild fluorosis is. Severe fluorosis is what initially attracted the attention of a dentist, Frederick McKay, in 1901 when he moved to Colorado Springs and realized that all of the kids there and many of the adults had what was called Colorado brown stain. And my early childhood was in the Rocky Mountain states, and I've seen that too. And it took about 30 years to really figure out that that fluoride in the water actually had an effect on preventing cavities. Severe fluorosis does not occur in water that with the appropriate dose, and moderate fluorosis doesn't normally occur in water that has the appropriate dose. And so I hasten to point out that this is a cosmetic issue, not really a health issue. Water fluoridation is one of the very few preventive actions that can be shown to be a cost-saving strategy. In one study in Louisiana, for example, Medicaid children with non-fluoridated water had twice the dental treatment costs as children living in communities with fluoridated water. And there are generally about $15 to $18 of savings to a community of individuals per person per year for fluoridation as compared to a community without fluoridation. So here's a mechanism that actually saves money. Now, when my youngest son was born out of the state, and we moved to the state when he was just finishing his primary school before he went to middle school, he had no cavities at all. He had absolutely perfect teeth, and the only cavity he got when he got here was when he rebelled against brushing his teeth with fluoride toothpaste, as teenagers sometimes do against the recommendations of their parents. But he's a little bit special. He had a physician for a father and a well-educated mother, and the real savings comes from people that don't have that, from people that can't afford regular dental care, for people that don't have a doctor and a lawyer as parents. And we who pay those bills for Medicaid children can actually save money while protecting those children. Now, from time to time, there are studies that surface that allege one health problem or another, including cancer. I have explored those issues since about 1975, when a gentleman walked into my office right after a very stressful site visit from the National Cancer Institute, and they agreed they were going to fund our project, and walked into my office and was showing me how fluoride caused cancer in San Francisco and some other studies, and I agreed to look at his information. Well, it turns out that he had done a completely inappropriate comparison. He didn't really understand the difference in coding systems from one decade to another. He didn't understand age adjustment and some other things that one has to do to make a fair comparison. But I was asked at that time by the governor of California to do a study in California, which I did, and I did very much the same thing that Dr. Cohen just described here. The water sanitation portion of the state health department there had levels of fluoride, either natural or administered, in various communities around California, and I was able to place them into three categories: high, medium, and low. And we looked at the cancer rates of various kinds of cancers in those three, and there was really no significant difference, but there was a very small excess among the ones with the least fluoride. So it didn't support his hypothesis or anyone's hypothesis at that time, but absolutely no difference. Now, I do want to point out that some people have pointed to a national toxicology program that initially provided equivocal evidence of increased osteosarcoma, which is a cancer of the bone, in male rats. This was, and I say equivocal because that's how the National Toxicology Program has described it. But when that same kind of an exposure was repeated later, they were not able to see that kind of an effect. And these rats were getting doses far larger than doses recommended for drinking water for humans. A study by the National Cancer Institute identified trends in cancer risk which could be attributed to the introduction of fluoride in drinking water. And the study, or they looked for that, the study was examined nationwide mortality and incidents from counties in Iowa and Seattle, Washington, where incidence data were collected by the National Cancer Institute. There were no consistent differences in trends in cancer mortality rates among males and females living in counties having initiated fluoridation. The relative mortality rates from cancer, including cancer of the bones and joints, were similar after 20 to 35 years of fluoridation as they were in the years preceding fluoridation. In addition, there was no relationship between the introduction and the duration of fluoridation and the pattern of cancer incidence rates, including those of the bone and joints and the subset of osteosarcomas. So, and that was very similar to what I found when I looked at the various communities and counties in California. There was absolutely no relationship. In a later time period, the National Cancer Institute used SEER data in two time periods, 73. I'm sorry?
SEER data.
Oh, I'm sorry. SEER data stands for Surveillance, Epidemiology, and End Results. And basically, it is data collected on every case of cancer within a defined population. And the National Cancer Institute has a program of collecting that kind of information nationally, which started in 1973. So by 1990, it was possible to sort of divide that up into two time periods and to see if there was any change in incidence rates. And there was an incidence change in incidence rates of osteosarcoma in young males under the age of 20 from 3.6 cases per million per year to 5.5 cases per million per year. And this compares to a slight decrease in young females of the same age from 3.8 to 3.7 cases per million per year. The amount of increase observed in young males was greater in the fluoridated and the non-fluoridated areas, but the reason for this is really not clear. And it is most likely a confounder based on the fact that an intensive analysis revealed that it's not related to the introduction of or the duration of fluoridation. Most recently, there was a study by Elise Basin of Harvard. This was part of her PhD requirements, and she looked at the relationship between drinking water, fluoridated drinking water, and the level of fluoride in drinking water, and during childhood, and osteosarcoma among males. And I can go into the details of that study if any of you prefer, but just let me summarize by saying that the findings are not replicable. She did not use actual measures of fluoride in bone, but rather her estimate based on some calculations that she made of exposure, and may even have interpreted the data incorrectly. But the point is that there's no convincing evidence that there's even an association, let alone a cause and effect relationship. The person with whom she worked to be able to get these cases is carrying on a much more detailed and in-depth study for longer periods of time, and actually did bone biopsies with in which they assessed the amount of fluoride in the bone. And that person, although that study is not yet published, writes a letter to the journal Cancer Causes and Control, where Basin's study is published, cautioning us against using the data from her study as a basis for the formulation of public policy, since he can't find the same thing in his data, although that has not yet gone through peer review. So I have appended a couple of documents with much more detail on the assessment of her study, and also with some very, illustrative pictures of fluorosis, if any of you are interested in looking at that. And I'll be happy to answer any questions on that or similar issues if you have them. Thank you.
Any questions? Is that a question I see in your
head? Down at that end, and then I'll go.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
Well, you might not thank me, so you better.
I will. I absolutely thank you.
I have a question, and it's regarding some testimony that focused on, and so I'm not sure whether Doctor would be able to address this for me, but that focused on the distinction between industrial grade fluoride, which is the current compound that's used to fluoridate water systems, versus pharmaceutical grade, which is a lesser toxicity than the pharmaceutical grade. What is the distinction? Do you see that as I need some clarity in that discussion.
I think my colleague
can
answer that.
Can join in on this.
Mr. Chair, Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health, and I hardly know where to begin because I am surrounded by a paradox. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I don't pretend to know. I appreciate the question. I know it is an issue that has come up in discussions. I'd be happy to try to get that information turned around for you and the rest of the committee for your discussion next week. I'm simply not prepared to respond to that question, which was unfortunately not part of my preparation for these questions.
So. Basically, the question is, what material is used in the fluoridation of water systems, and how does that compare to other forms of the same material that might be used? We're not using elemental fluoride, I assume.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. Let me start by saying that the department requires drinking water additives to meet purity standards from the National Sanitation Foundation. NSF 60, we require water suppliers that add fluoride to test daily and report monthly and conduct quarterly quality assurance comparison testing. There are three approved forms of the fluoride for drinking water, two solid and one in a liquid form. Sodium fluoride, sodium silica fluoride, and hydrofluorosilic acid. Each of those is applied using a feed apparatus appropriate to the individual form used. I believe, and I'm going to stop here, but whatever and wherever and from whatever source any of those approved forms of fluoride come, for use by the water system, they all must meet the NSF 60 purity standards. I'd be happy to do some additional research about industrial grade, as you put it, I believe, versus a pharmaceutical grade to provide the committee.
Thank you. And just as a quick add to that, thank you, Ms. Shibley. I think what I want to clarify is that I think that there have been, the case has been presented that basically we're talking about toxic waste used to dump into our water system, and that causes some concern.
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, I clearly that's a policy question that flip on a sunny Friday afternoon, that's what you get paid the big bucks for, it's a very important one, certainly from a public health standpoint. I don't mean to minimize it at all. I would defer to my colleague Dr. Cohn in terms of toxicity of any element that is ingested into the human body. I'm way over my league, and I'd be happy to have turn to him and see if he has any concerns about labeling something a toxic versus not a toxic. I think in his response to earlier, there may have been some connection to that.
Well, but I do keep hearing about this thing that what people use to fluoridate water systems is toxic waste from a product that produces uranium, from a process that produces waste uranium, and variety of other things. It would be very useful if we could get some sense of what that means, where it came from, what are the products we use, and where do they come from.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chair. Clearly, it comes from the earth. It is mined, quarried, and as you have pointed out before, there is naturally occurring fluoride. There's naturally occurring fluoride here in Oregon. So it's a question of how you package it, how you use it, and what you call it.
Those products are mined products. They don't come from an industrial production process of some kind.
Mr. Chair, I
it would be very helpful if you could find some of that information for us.
Yes. Well, I just want to make a quick comment on that. I think that the question and the distinction about toxic waste and toxic waste byproduct is a good conversation to have, but it's also I don't want it to cloud the issue. I mean, you can take a desalinization plant, and if you're after water, then your toxic byproduct is pure salt. Oh. It's still toxic at any at a high level, as was described earlier. So we have to be a little bit careful about toxic waste versus a byproduct of some process.
Yeah. Representative Cannon and then Representative Kotek.
Thank you, and I think I'll address my questions of the paradox, although maybe any of the three of you can. We'll just keep that going. I guess my presumption is that perhaps all three of you, by virtue of your work, are connected in some respect, at least, to the worldwide community of folks, epidemiologists, health researchers, et cetera. And I wonder if you'd speculate on why most countries in Western Europe, for instance, have chosen not to fluoridate water, in some cases have ended water fluoridation. Is the scientific kind of consensus there different? Just maybe any thoughts on that?
I don't know why they've I don't know of any scientific reason why they have elected, if they have elected, not to to discontinue fluoridation. I do know that Britain, for example, has done a very detailed University of York, I believe, has done a very detailed assessment of water fluoridation using a set of evidence-based criteria where they discount most of the kinds of studies that are used in water fluoridation because they're not randomized clinical trials. We don't randomly assign children one by one to a trial. Fluoridation got the benefit of fluoridation, like penicillin, got discovered before those randomized clinical trials became useful. But they still concluded that even though most of these were not done with randomized clinical trials and they were all observational studies that would probably not pass, most of them would not pass funding muster for today, that the level of evidence was convincing that they were effective and safe. That was in Britain. And I don't know why, if Germany decided to quit it, I don't know why they did.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, no, I don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The whole concept of toxicity, and maybe this is information you can get us, because, like we've said, anything at certain levels can be toxic. And there are minerals that we ingest through vitamins or other things that I would assume could be some kind of byproduct. No one's out there, you know, mining these things just to make vitamins. And so I'm just wondering if you can provide us with information around at what level is a mineral toxic, how is that determined, and then I also would love to see the source data for the different types of fluorides. But I guess the question is, who has approved that list of types of fluoride, Ms. Shipley? Is that the federal government? I didn't know who that was.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kotick, that's correct. It is at the federal level. It is not here in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
You said it's a foundation.
Chair Greenlick, the purity standards are set by the National Sanitation Foundation.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, you know, as I was thinking about this issue in preparation for today, I started to think about the many examples of supplementation of foodstuffs that have made incredible inroads in the public health world. And I actually, it being Friday afternoon, if I may, I brought a few pictures and a couple of stories to briefly tell you that, because I think perhaps that would increase your comfort level with this idea of fortification and supplementation using minerals like this. You know, the first example that comes to mind is iodine that's in table salt. This is a picture of a woman with a goiter. This used to be a very common problem. It's a relatively...
Other country.
That's right, where iodine intake was very low. It's a relatively uncommon problem now. There are some other causes of goiter as well. But the addition of iodine to table salt has made an enormous difference in that. This is a picture of a young child. It might surprise you to know that in the 1920s, the most common nutritional disease of children that affected 75% of infants in New York City was rickets, and it causes this kind of bow-legged problem with the bones. This is solved with vitamin D supplementation of milk, and we all drink that every time we drink a glass of milk. Recently, we have started to fortify cereal grains with folate to prevent spina bifida and anencephaly. This is a picture of a child with spina bifida. We've cut the rates of this kind of birth defect in half with this kind of supplementation. Pellagra is a disease I don't even know, probably many of you have never even heard of pellagra. Pellagra was a disease that was first recognized after the Civil War. It's diagnosed using the four Ds, diarrhea, dermatitis, dementia, and unfortunately death. It can be a very, very serious disease, and it's due to a deficiency of niacin. During the period from 1906 to 1940, there were 3 million cases of pellagra and 100,000 deaths in the U.S. from this disease. And this is a disease that has virtually disappeared, in large part because we supplement our flour with niacin now. So this is a tried and true public health practice. Most of these things, if taken to excess, do cause serious problems. We don't control the dose of flour that somebody eats. We don't control the dose of salt that somebody eats. And yet these have been extremely effective interventions from the public health realm. So perhaps that will increase the comfort level with this kind of approach.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask, actually, a continuation of that line of thinking, and so why don't we supplement other foods with fluoride or salt with fluoride?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Mara, I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but I assume it has something to do with the chemistry of this. This is the substances that Gail Shibley described a minute ago dissolve in water, and so it's an easy way to administer them. I'm not sure. Perhaps it is possible to supplement other kinds of food with some of these.
No, because I know that other countries use salt. That's pretty common in Central America, I believe. And in Western Europe, I think that's an option. But at least it gives consumers options when they make these decisions, because you can still buy non-iodized salt.
That's very easy. Well, I know when I was 16 and worked in a grocery store, you sold as much ionized as non-ionized. I bet it's pretty hard to find now.
What, no. Yeah, my wife always buys the non-iodized and say, no, go back. I'm the one that has to go. So it's still out there. But my point is that it allows a consumer the choice, because you can, you know, choose to use non-fluoridated toothpaste, I suppose, if you could find it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, I know that in the pediatric world, to address the infant formula issue, what we would tell mothers is that when mixing up formula from water, you should use bottled water that does not have fluoride in it. So consumers would still have that choice, even if the public water supplies that were coming out of the tap were fluoridated.
Was that a gasp, or was that a question, Representative Cote?
I think Representative Bonamici had a question. Okay. And I have a question.
Thank
okay.
you. I'd like to follow up on that a bit, because we've talked a lot about the whole socioeconomic factor, and I know Dr. Austin talked about that with regard to it's probably not the kids of the upper income levels whose parents make them brush their teeth and have healthy nutrition and don't put soda pop in their baby bottles. But how are we going to get to families who are mixing baby formula, bottled water without fluoride in it? How are we going to who's going to pay for that? Who's going to educate them that that's what they should be using?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, again, experience in other places has shown that it can be done, and it is done. Before I came to Oregon, I was practicing pediatrics in Louisiana and New Orleans. I don't believe that I ever saw a case of fluorosis in my time there, and certainly worked with plenty of very, very poor people who, you know, one would think this would be an issue, and so they were able to deal with that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please just roll.
Thank you. And when you said to deal with that, do you mean giving bottled water to families who are mixing infant formula, bottled water without fluoride? Because it's my understanding that ADA recommendation is pretty recent, to not mix baby formula with fluoridated water.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, the issues around fluorosis and excessive fluoride exposure have been around for a very long time, and they've been recognized for a very long time, even if the ADA recommendation itself is relatively.
Thank you. And I had another question about what Dr. Austin was mentioning, the cost saving of water fluoridation. And I know we have at least somewhere in our bulky folder something from the city of Portland talking about their startup cost to fluoridate water would be somewhere between $3.5 to $4.5 million and about $600,000 a year. And I think that would provide a lot of dental care to needy children. Instead of spending that amount of money fluoridating water, especially in a community that's already voted 3 times that they didn't want fluoride in the water, I'd prefer to see that money going directly to children who need help, the health care and the dental care. So I wonder if you could respond to that, using that amount of money.
We don't have a fiscal on this bill yet, and I doubt those are I mean, I doubt if we don't pass this bill, there'll be that much money going into the into Downcare. I mean, it would be nice if it was. I really would probably agree that that's the case. I don't think they can really answer the policy question that we have in Ways and Means. If this really was not true, there were two bills, spend $30 million on dental care for kids or spend $30 million on fluoride and water.
Well, Mr. Chair, but this nothing now forbids a jurisdiction that wants fluoride from having fluoride. But what we're doing with this bill is mandating it, and so we need to talk about the cost.
All I was saying is, if we pass this bill and it has a cost on it, it will be decided by Ways and Means whether or not to fund it. But it won't be going back and saying either, if we pass this bill and send it forward with a fiscal, either spend the fiscal here or add it to the money you were planning on spending for health care for children. I mean, that's
exactly why
we don't have that. It isn't an option we have. It isn't the way the Ways and Means process goes.
Mr. Chair.
Before you go further, I wonder, Ms. Shibley, I expect you had some testimony that was short-circuited. Could you?
Mr. Chair, you're too kind. I believe that I provided the information that had been asked before in terms of the forms of fluoride that are used, how it is administered through a feed apparatus, what kind of control measures and oversight is performed routinely on site. As I mentioned, the water supplier measures the amount of fluoride and the amount of water treated, calculates the dosage from that. They measure the concentration of the fluoride in the water every day and checks that against that calculated dose. The optimal dose for dental protection is one part per million. EPA has established a maximum contaminant level for fluoride of four parts per million to protect human health, skeletal fluorosis. I would only add parenthetically, everything, if you will, within drinking water, within the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, is basically listed as a contaminant. So I use that term as a term of art, not as a descriptor of a generic ingredient or component, if you will. As you may be very familiar, MCLs are kind of the lingo whenever you're talking about water or air quality, for that matter. EPA has also established a secondary maximum contaminant level of two parts per million to avoid the mottling, that is considered an aesthetic effect, not a human health effect. Although, again, the optimal dose for fluoride addition to drinking water is one part per million. I will only, I guess, end by saying that surveying some considerable institutional knowledge and memory and experience within Public Health Division, there is not any memory or knowledge of any violation of any community in Oregon during our time of oversight. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to try to hurry and provide other information that the committee may find useful.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was wondering if anyone else was going to testify.
There is no more planned testimony. I will. We have a few minutes. I will. Yeah, if we're done this panel, thank you for coming. Okay, we're not done. Let's go.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I have a comment. Well, first, I would just really caution us colleagues when we talk about the cost of this. I am very uncomfortable about talking about spending money that we might spend on fluoridation on dental care and thinking that's going to solve this issue.
All right.
And I think we have to look at access to dental care. We have to think about, you know, if we all thought about handling rickets, for example, why not just all have vitamin D tablets? There's a methodology here that is cost-effective. I would not want to go down that road unless we had someone who's dealing with the healthcare issue to really tell us if how many visits would a child have to have to meet the prevention capability of fluoride, and how many dentists would we have to have? I mean, I just think we should be careful there. When someone says we should go out and buy tubes of toothpaste for everyone, I don't think that's an effective method. So I just caution us on the cost issue, that there are a lot of factors to consider there. The other issue is the pediatrician that presented information in our packets, Dr. Feldman, who is a fellow with the American Academy of Pediatrics, addresses the baby formula issue. You know, the reality is the only safest issue for is breastfeeding, is breast milk. Anytime we put anything in with formula, it's a problem. I'm not saying fluoride. Fluoride is not is maybe one issue, but there are certainly others, and that is why we strive to have mothers breastfeed in the state, because that is the only thing we can say is safe and effective. Formula is a host of problems with it, regardless of the fluoride issue. So I just want to make sure that everyone makes note of that in their package. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can either of the three, this paradox and the other, help with this information that was also presented? There were some graphs that indicated there was a very marginal benefit from the fluoride that was in a water system as compared to the systems without. So is there any information that you can provide us, and perhaps the committee administrator could provide you copies of that so that you might be able to have something to look and say, well, you know, this may be a little off here, or perhaps this is legitimate in this area. I would like to have that input back. I just have to tell you, because I have, and all of those who are opponents here know, I have always been a fluoride supporter, but with this overwhelming amount of information that's coming forward, I want to be sure that I am making the best informed policy decision for this state that I can, weighing the evidence.
Chairman Green, Representative Flores, I haven't seen those tables. I did cite for you the first time that it was used in Grand Rapids, Michigan, when there was a 60% reduction in cavities in 11 years. 60%. And that we find less of a supportive, less of a reduction now, simply because fluoride gets into some of those communities in other ways. And if there was a community, if you were cherry-picking communities that were wealthy, you would not find as much of a difference as you would if you were looking at Medicaid populations, for example. And it's really the Medicaid populations and those without insurance, those without access to good dental care, that is the primary concern here. And those are the ones for whom we pay the patch-up kind of dental care, and who do less well without this kind of protection and support. I should also mention that the American Dietary Association has listed fluoride as a necessary nutrient rather than a toxin. So it again points to the issue that it is the perspective. If you call something a toxic waste, it makes it look worse than if you call it a nutrient. But in fact, our health is protected by having low amounts of it, just like it's protected having low amounts of iodine. And large amounts is poisonous.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make one point, because we've talked about Grand Rapids a couple of times. I grew up in Michigan, and water fluoridation started in Grand Rapids, but that was before there was fluoride in toothpaste. So I just wanted to make that point.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Flores, I'll be happy to take a look at that graph and get some information back to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I actually do have one more question, and try to keep it brief. But one of the challenges that we face in making this decision is sort of the overwhelming, you know, pile of scientific evidence and so on that's been put into our hands. And so I'm going to ask you to make a characterization about the sort of history of research into this subject. I guess my theory is that there has been quite a bit more kind of peer-reviewed, legitimate research that attempts to examine the dental benefits of fluoride and the like minimum and maximum dosages that are effective, then there has been research that's asked the question, what are possible harmful side effects? That if you look over the history of fluoride research, say the last 60 years in this country, many more of the good studies have asked the question, I'm just restating this now, but have asked the question, is this beneficial in terms of the health of our teeth? Then have asked the question, are there potentially harmful side effects? So I'm just curious if you can could characterize, am I correct in that theory?
Chairman Grin, Representative Cannon, my guess would be that you are probably right in that. But in order to look for problems, you have to have an idea of what you might look for. Those problems that have been claimed have usually been assessed by either state governments, federal governments, or independent researchers and found to be wanting. I have not seen one that documents a significant health risk. On the other hand, every major scientific group that has examined the issue in this country, including the last five surgeon generals, have recommended it. And in fact, Dr. Koop, Surgeon General Koop, made the statement that this was one of the most significant public health advances in that century, last century.
After vaccination.
Beg your pardon?
After vaccination.
That wasn't his statement.
The century before. That's true.
Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your coming today. Gail, you'll get us some information, and I'm not sure which table we're talking about, but if we can get...
And Mr. Chair, Representative Flores ran up to get her notebook so that you guys could see what it is she's referring to, so if you could give us just a couple minutes in the back before you leave. Thanks.
Okay. We have three people who've asked to testify. If I can ask them to come up and take 3 or 4 minutes or 5 minutes each. Let's see. There's Kimberly Kaminsky, Brent Foster, and Bob Nagel.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself.
Okay.
I only see two.
Oh.
Brent Foster? Good.
Come on, John.
It'd be helpful if we could be out by about 4:45. Let's see how we can follow up with questions.
We got 5 minutes apiece.
Okay, whoever wants to start.
I'll begin. Good afternoon, Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Kimberly Kaminsky. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. Some of the comments that I have today are in answer to Representative Flores's question about the product, and I would like to wait until she returns.
Wait until she comes back. That'd be great.
Okay.
Somebody else want to start? She just went up to get her notebook so she could provide the material.
Okay.
Well, I could begin, and part of what I have is an answer, and this is the graph on the Grand Rapids and Muskegon test. And Grand Rapids was fluoridated in 1949. Well, anyway, the pre-fluoridation test showed a decayed, missing, and filled, which they call DMFT.
Excuse me, can you please put your name for the record?
That's 6.3.
Would you please put your name in for the record?
Oh, excuse me. I'm new at this.
Yes,
okay.
No problem.
My name is Bob Nagel, and I'm from Portland.
Thank you.
I'm not a doctor and not an expert in this. I'm just a concerned citizen with children, and I'm concerned about what I've come to know about the effects of fluoride and its history. And
Mr. Nagel, could you say what book you're reading from?
I'm reading from a book called Fluoride, the Aging Factor. I can't pronounce the author's last name. John Iana Momlin something.
And is he a doctor?
He is, yes.
Doctor of?
I'm not sure what is,
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyway, the before and after numbers are not 60% as given to us by the people speaking earlier. The average before was 6.31 bad teeth. Then the period afterwards was, it went down to 5.14. This seems significant. A drop of 1.16 bad teeth per child, or per person. This is all age groups, actually, up to 16. However, in Muskegon, with non-fluoridation, it was slightly higher to start with than Grand Rapids before fluoridation, 6.52, dropped to 5.81, a drop of 0.72. They experienced a similar drop, and the numbers are not significantly different.
What's the time period of those, between those two?
Okay, the first test was 1944 to 1945 was the test, the before.
The baseline.
And 1949 to 1950 was the after. So they'd had apparently...
That was the whole population?
Age of 5 to 16.
5 to 16.
So... Representative Flores, this was really for you. I'm sorry,
oh, thank
we
you.
Kind of jumped ahead. The Grand Rapids and Muskegon study here, in a little bit in refutation of what the earlier testimony showed. The before in Grand Rapids, fluoridated, decayed, missing, or filled teeth per child, 6.31, dropped to 5.14. And in Muskegon, the test, which had no fluoridation, 6.52, dropped to 5.81. So the drop was not... There was actually Muskegon or Grand Rapids scored a little bit better with fluoride, maybe insignificant though. It wasn't 60%, it probably wasn't 1%. So they use that though as a test, a thing to go forward. A little bit earlier, somebody asked, where does the fluoride come from? Is it medical grade? Is it pharmaceutical grade? I can show you that this is a picture of fluoride. It's sodium fluoride packaged by McKesson as insecticide. Pure insecticide. It was also used for rat poison at that time. Those were the two main uses for sodium fluoride prior to Alcoa, Aluminum Company of America here, and this is their ad from about that time, saying put it in your water here. Drink, fluoridate your water with confidence, use high-quality Alcoa sodium fluoride. Where it came from at that time was it's a byproduct of the aluminum smelting industry. It was a little bit of a problem as to what to do with all of it that they were making, and it does contain some trace amounts of heavy metals, aluminum, lead, arsenic, etc.
Mr. Nagel?
Pardon?
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. It sounds like you might have some information to answer the question that we posed to Ms. Shipley, and she says there are three types of fluoride that we can put in our water. And does that book, I'm trying to get a sense if that's an historical perspective, or that actually says specifically where, well...
So sodium fluoride is what it shows. Now, there
are some other ones. But excuse
Brent may have the difference. There's specific differences in the other two. And
I would only ask if we're going to bring this subject up is to connect the dots and say, we know for a fact that X goes to X goes to X. And we haven't even heard from our water expert that we know exactly where that comes from. So I just want to make sure that when we answer that question, we're speaking currently in Oregon.
Okay.
What we use and where.
And the sodium fluorosilicate.
And can I go back to your Grand Rapids?
Yes.
What was the, how many years between the baseline and the...
The baseline was created in the years 1944 to 1945,
and
the second numbers were generated between 1949 and 1950.
So it's a five-year time period?
Yeah, I believe that's right, 4 to 5 years.
The data that Dr. Austin reported was an 11-year time period? Some data. You're going to refute his 60% that happened in 11 years. The decreased dental caries in school children over 60%. Do you have some 11-year data or 10-year data?
I don't, but I know that this was the study that was used to extend fluoridation throughout the country.
All I can say is if you're trying to refute Dr. Austin's data.
Yes.
Dr. Austin's report was an 11-year follow-up period.
Okay.
Which gave the fluoride more time to...
Okay, we have some other cities here that we can look at. Pardon?
Are you you said you're refuting his testimony.
Well, and I'm not sure what specific technical terms I should use. I'm adding some data. Representative Flores asked, what really happened there, and, he just said, a 60% reduction.
In 11 years.
Okay, now... Okay, so maybe what I'm saying is that this is the study that I believe what he was talking about, and this was a five-year one. Now, I don't know about any 11-year studies. So
are we done?
I guess I'm Brent Foster. I'm a director of Columbia Riverkeeper on the board of the state Sierra Club. I guess I'd like to answer your question first. There are three fluoridation projects which are used today. Two of them, and predominantly about 80% of the fluoride, and this data comes from the Center for Disease Control Fluoridation Census, 80% of the projects are based on They're basically one of two things, either sodium fluorosilicate, which is the label that you see here, and this isn't just a good propaganda. It actually does come with a toxic warning on it, because certainly at that concentrations, it's toxic. It's toxic if you expose it to your skin. Sodium fluoride is used in a much smaller sodium fluoride, or basically variations on that is more commonly. There are pharmaceutical varieties of sodium fluoride. They are not used, and as I testified before the House committee, no water, municipal water system right now uses pharmaceutical grade. As on page
30... Mr. Chair, Mr. Yes. Foster, why is that?
It's a matter of cost. Like when the city of Beaverton decided to fluoridate its water, they looked at the cost and they said, it's too expensive to provide pharmaceutical grade, so we will instead provide the non-pharmaceutical
but
grade.
Why would you? I mean, pharmaceutical grade is what an individual dose would be from an individual. When you're talking about an industrial process of fluoridating water system, why would you use pharmaceutical grade?
Well, I think that the idea is that just like you would consume pharmaceutical products, you consume water. And the idea would be to have the highest purity level you could get that made sense. One of the practical problems...
No, it didn't. I mean, when you produce a product for individual consumption, you're dealing with an individual dose, which is obviously much higher than one part per million, and it does need to have a different purity. The question is the one part per million use of something that is an industrial grade create any kind of purity hazard? It doesn't matter just that it's industrial grade.
I would answer that with two things, and I apologize since we're not aware that we were going to be testifying. I don't have multiple copies, but the problem is not just kind of the...
You have to be on market if you wander off the gate.
The problem is not just this philosophical problem that these are, first of all, there's no dispute either that these are not just mined and put in the water. Page 13 of the recent National Academy of Science report, silica fluorides are one of the byproducts from the manufacture of phosphate fertilizer. Similarly, the CDC Center for Disease Control's Tom Reeds, who was their head of fluoridation engineers, he's now retired, but while he was working for him, starts off a note to the file from September 2000, which is I have provided some of you copies with. I'm happy to provide everyone. Quote, all of the fluoridation chemicals used in the U.S. for water fluoridation, sodium fluoride, sodium fluorosilicate, and fluorosilicic acid are byproducts of the phosphate fertilizer industry. Now, the reason why that's a problem is that they all also contain arsenic, lead, mercury, chromium, and a number of other compounds that at extremely minute levels can have and do have direct effects. And what I have here is a table. This is from, you heard about the National Sanitation Foundation earlier. This is a report from the National Sanitation Foundation, which goes through and identifies the quantities of these arsenic, lead, things like that, that are present in drinking water, the stuff we finish drinking water, directly just as a result of the water fluoridation. So I will definitely provide copies of all this to the committee members. And while the levels are low, they're at the part per million level, part per billion level in some cases, in Oregon, where we've got 135 communities that already exceed the arsenic standard, where they've already tested for too much arsenic, it doesn't make sense to add more. When most mothers have too much mercury in their blood already, the idea that we would do anything that added more is a problem. I think the same thing with mercury and lead. We know that there is no safe dose of lead, because even at the smallest identifiable risks, there is a directly correlative impact on childhood IQ. From that, it is both a philosophical and, I think, representative. I'm sorry. Look like you had a question.
No.
Oh.
Okay. I have a question. I mean, the notion that we come across none of these products in our daily life in these extraordinarily small doses of parts per billion. I mean, we live in a world that has all sorts of things. I mean, adding one part per billion or one part per zillion of these drugs, I mean, of these products is, I mean, there is no evidence that there's any problem with doing that.
Representative Greenleck, I think that there's numerous scientific studies that show...
So adding one part per billion of...
Well, actually, for example, with arsenic, the drinking level is less than the drinking level is about 5 parts per billion, and just the amount that was attributable in this study, they found maximum contaminant levels for arsenic were 1.66. So you're talking, I'm sorry, 10. It's
what's the difference in arsenic level in the water that is fluoridated in our state versus the water that's not fluoridated.
What it is saying right here is that it's on this is from their maximum thing, just from 100 sample sizes, 1.66 parts per billion difference.
In our state, where we've had fluoridated water, is there any evidence that there's difference in arsenic or lead
yes.
or any of these products
between,
say, Beaverton and...
How about this? When the city of Lebanon fluoridated its water, and this was reported in the newspaper in the last session, and I have the actual water reports from Lebanon, their lead levels, the number of houses that exceeded EPA's action level for lead doubled. Okay. Now, what they in turn did was that they hired CH2M Hill, who came in. They said, why did our lead levels double?
The lead levels doubled
the number
in water?
The number of houses that with drinking water levels, lead levels, that exceeded EPA's action level doubled in after they added fluoride. This, you know, again, the city manager, when asked, what was the effect of water fluoridation? Have you noticed any difference on teeth? He said, no, all we noticed was our lead levels increased. I'll provide you that newspaper article as well. Now, the reason why is that, fluorosilicic acid is, of course, an acid. When the city of Portland wanted to decrease its lead levels, what it did is it made the water more basic by adding, essentially, chalk to the water. And it worked. You can lower that.
So the issue isn't the lead as a contaminant. The issue is... the pH leaching lead out of the pipes.
There are two different components of lead. One is that you do add lead in the source product. What you asked me, is there any evidence when you fluoridate that you get an increased lead level? The one evidence...
No, I didn't say that. That isn't what I asked you. I asked you, is there any evidence that the lead level in the water or the arsenic level in the water is significantly different in the cities that are fluoridated versus cities that aren't? If there's a pH problem... That's a whole different issue.
We have two different answers. I guess the answer is yes to both of them. This chart, which specifies how much lead is added to fluoridated drinking water as a result of arsenic and chromium and mercury, supports that when you fluoridate, it will increase the level of those toxins.
Let me see if I can convert my question into English so it'll be easier to understand. My question was, is there any evidence that the lead levels or the arsenic levels in cities in Oregon that are fluoridated is different than the cities in Oregon that are not fluoridated?
And
I would argue that those levels are so low that you can't measure them. So I was asking, is there any measurable difference? The very simple say, if you're adding lead to the water, go measure the lead in the water.
I guess Representative Greenlick, Chairman, is the best I can answer is, again, yes, in that
give me the yes that measures the lead in the water in those two cities.
Sure.
Give me how much difference in lead there is in the drinking water of those cities. Don't give me other evidence. Don't give me anything else. I mean, the answer to that might be no. It's a perfectly good answer.
What I'm just telling you is that in the context of Lebanon, which is the one place I have looked, and compared the pre-fluoridation and post-fluoridation, as agreed to by their city manager, and when they had to call in CHM2 to have a thing, now, the cause of that, I don't have the CH2M report, but I can just...
I'm going to ask you a different question. I'm going to ask you the same question, but I'm going to keep asking it.
Okay.
Because I believe the answer is no, that there is no evidence, but I want you to show me evidence that water coming out of the pipes in Lebanon, coming out of the city water supply, turns out different in Lebanon than it is in Salem. Salem, Florida?
Yes.
Than it is in Eugene or somewhere that doesn't have water. I don't want to hear about unsafe houses. I want to ask that you can measure water as it comes out of the water supply.
Yes, sir.
And the question is, when you take water as it comes right out of the water supply, is there any evidence yet that there's a difference in the lead level or the arsenic level in the water as it's coming out of the water supply and a fluoridated water supply than in an unfluoridated water supply? And if there is evidence of that, if there's an answer to that question that has evidence, it's a simple answer. It's yes. We measured it in Beaverton and we measured it in Portland, and here was the difference in the results.
Well, first of all, I think as an important point, you would be comparing apples and oranges.
You'd be comparing apples and apples.
Well,
you're comparing apples and oranges.
Well, each community water supply is going to have a different background level. So if I compare Portland to Ashland or Ashland to Eugene, that's not scientifically valid. Like, let's say Corvallis had a higher lead level. Unless I knew what their background level was before fluoridation, I wouldn't be scientifically accurate to compare it to Portland.
Are there places that come out of Bull Water? I mean, out of Bull Run? That you can compare Portland to Beaver did say?
That's a good question and not one I thought of.
Is there any evidence that that has happened in those places?
All I can tell you, not something
it's
that I've looked
question.
At. I've
yeah,
said not you, something that I've looked at.
Okay, you don't have any evidence about that.
It's
that
not something
saying?
That I've looked at. I can't say if there's evidence there or
the
not.
The question is, do you have evidence? That's a simple question. That can have a yes or no answer. Do you have evidence? How hard is that question?
Well, I guess I keep answering the question. And
your answer is yes, and I say, give me the evidence, and you give me some other answer. So the answer is yes or no. If it's yes, I have evidence, here's the evidence.
If the question is still, is there
my
a difference
question.
Between Bull Run water,
no.
a city that's fluoridated and unfluoridated with Bull Run water? Then the answer is what I said, which is I don't have any evidence on that question.
Okay. Do you have any evidence on any other measurements of water supplies in fluoridated places and in non-fluoridated places that show the fluoridated places coming out of the water supply have higher levels of lead and arsenic? Either you have evidence that asks that.
Well,
and don't tell me why that's not the right question.
Okay.
Do you have any evidence that when you measure water coming out of fluoridated water supply and coming out of unfluoridated water supplies, that there is more lead and more arsenic in the water coming out of fluoridated water supplies?
I can only go back to my original answer.
No, you can answer the question, do you have yes, do you have evidence, or do you not have evidence? I know you're a river keeper, and I know scientific evidence is hard for you to deal with. I'm asking you a very simple question. And the answer is, yes, I have evidence, and here it is, or no, I don't have evidence.
I have evidence that says when you add fluoride to water, you will get an increased level concentration of arsenic, lead, and all the other stuff. Now, and
you can ask any other questions you want. I'm asking you a specific question. Have there been measurements? It's a very simple question. It shouldn't be. You're on the board of the Sierra Club. You ought to be able to understand.
The measurements are right here.
That's the answer to your question. Let's try my question. Do you have any evidence that measurements of water coming out of the source in a fluoridated water supply versus in a non-fluoridated water supply has higher levels of arsenic and lead in them?
Yes.
Okay, and what is that evidence? What's the measurements of the difference in arsenic and lead in water coming out of the fluoridated water system and water coming out of a non-fluoridated water system?
When water was coming out of the unfluoridated water system of the city of Lebanon, compared to when it
measurement
was
measurement as it was coming out of the source.
Measured as it was coming out when it was.
Oh, I'm talking. You've got to answer my question.
Source.
You can't change the question.
You're not talking about someone's tap, like where they.
I'm not.
It.
I'm talking about it when it comes out of the water system. Because as you point out, there can be pH changes, there can be a variety of other changes, but your assertion is that you're putting measurable amounts of arsenic and lead in the water system. And I frankly don't believe that assertion. So I'm asking you, do you have any evidence that when you measure water coming right out of the water supply, there is a measurable difference in arsenic and lead? I really want you to deal with
I want to understand your question so
okay.
I can answer
I'll be
it
happy
after.
To explain.
So your question is essentially at some point between the water plant, and but not once it gets to people's houses, but some point before it goes through the city pipes.
Yes.
Is there a level between the water after you add the fluoride in?
You measure the safety of water in a water system by measuring it as it comes right out of the source. You don't measure it in somebody's house 4 miles away.
Actually,
you measure the purity of the water as it comes out of the water system. So my question is, it's a simple question, you have any evidence in measurements of water coming out of the water system where purity is measured in water systems that there is a measurably different amount of lead or arsenic in the water of fluoridated water system than non-fluoridated water system? You can talk about different backgrounds. You can talk about all these other things. My simple question is, you've made an assertion, and it's a powerful assertion, and I think it's a false assertion.
Right.
So what I'm asking you is evidence in direct support of what I think is an incorrect assertion. And somewhere along the line, you're going to say, no, I don't have any evidence. I want to keep trying until we get to that.
If you want to confine and you want to present the question
I
in
do.
A way so that I can only answer no, I'll just tell
no,
you.
No, no,
right
I
now.
No, I don't.
But,
I'd be delighted for you to answer yes. I'd be delighted for you to say, yes, I have evidence that backs my assertion, where water is measured at the point it's supposed to be measured for purity, not in somebody's house.
See, there's an inherent problem with your question because
I don't care if it's an inherent problem.
Water isn't measured at the pipe. It's measured in people's houses.
No, no, it's not. The purity of water in a water system is measured when it comes out of the source.
That
is where it's measured.
The data under the Safe Drinking Water Act, which looks at lead and arsenic and is what I have relied on, is measured in people's houses. I have the reports on my computer. I don't disagree that there are probably other reports that look at water coming out of the treatment plant and the treatment plant.
But you yourself said that the increase in lead in a house 5 miles downstream could be because of the pH of the water, not of the fact that we've added lead because we're using industrial waste products to fluoridate water systems. You're arguing we're using industrial waste products to fluoridate water systems and doing that is increasing the lead and arsenic levels in those water systems.
Correct.
And I don't believe you have any evidence of that assertion because there are a variety of other factors, as you know, particularly the most important one has to do with leaching lead out of the pipes downstream.
Correct.
And that's not about the industrial waste that's being used.
Oh, it directly is. Because I think that's maybe where we're like ships passing in the night. Because our problem with sodium fluorosilicate or fluorosilicic acid.
Your problem with that product is that it has a toxic label on it.
And no, my problem
and
with
the,
it. Well, we have multiple problems with it. It's not merely the label. And I don't want to...
Well, you keep showing the label as your evidence.
No,
I see.
But the point is, when you add an acid product, like the fluorosilicic acid, to the water, you are adding something which will leach lead, and that is one...
Well, then
impact.
You deal with it by affecting the pH, not by affecting what
that,
you
that's one
it.
Solution. You
simple solution.
Well, at some level... You can only put so much chalk in the water before it doesn't taste good. So we can address that.
Chalk in the water?
That's what...
By taste test, proven to be the best tasting water in the country.
I'm not going to disagree. The most I can say, and I've tried my best to answer your question. All I can say is, one, whether you can, and maybe this is going to your question, you're saying, are detection limits enough that you can measure it? And all I can say is where the studies that I have, and, you know, I do a lot of things, but the couple studies that I have specifically looked at for Lebanon showed that there were an increase and that they were measurable, and it was inside the house. My understanding would be that was due, I can't say whether it was due to the concentration, so I'll give you that point there. I can't say it was due to the lead in there. Studies have shown, Masters and Copeland has actually looked at blood levels in fluoridated and unfluoridated communities.
This isn't a debating game. I really want to make sure you understand what's going on here. We're facing a very important public policy issue. Some of the pieces of what we have to deal with is what the scientific basis of the dangers of this are. We've been faced with what I believe, as a member of the National Academy of Science for over 35 years, is bogus scientific data. And I think you're adding more bogus scientific data to this question, and I'm trying to deal with that. We're going to have to make this decision on the basis of very hard political questions. It's not only is there evidence that supports it, is there evidence that supports the hazards, but someone we're going to have to make a very difficult personal decision on Monday when we're voting on this about what our constituents think. And we don't have exactly measures of what our constituents think. But what I'm trying to do is to make sure that information that's being presented to us, scientific information, is being presented by legitimate scientists, and that there's a scientific basis for what they're saying. It's not, here I have this fact, and here I have some data over here. Oh, and forget the facts I said. Let's deal with what I'm presenting. I mean, I don't think we need scientific sleight of hand.
I agree. And what I've passed over, what is over at the assistance is a study that looked, I think, gets to the question of what you're saying. Is it actually resulting in more lead in people's bodies? I think that's ultimately the question that we want to know. And what this study found, interestingly, is that for two of the three fluoridation products, you had significant increase in blood lead levels. 100 person, 1,000 based on data, hotly contested. The people behind me would probably say it's junk science or whatever. It's published, it's peer-reviewed. It is data that shows increased lead levels, especially in African American and Latino families, where you're more likely to live in houses with lead pipes or things like that.
And lead paint?
Sure.
And higher concentrations
absolutely.
Of lead in the gasoline fumes?
And what it found, though, but remember, it compared those subgroups in both fluoridated and unfluoridated communities. And within the comparison, what this study found was significant increase of blood lead in fluoridated communities. For two of the three fluoride subproducts, did not find a similar association with sodium fluoride. Did find it with the other two. So, you know, there's no answers to the scientific question.
So, Mr. Foster, thank you, and thank you for accepting all these questions. But on the question on the sodium fluoride, so therefore, would you be supportive of the use of sodium fluoride in particular because it was not found to be an issue in that particular study?
For reasons, other reasons like the infant formula warning, like the Harvard Cancer Study, other things like that, which frankly didn't address whether or not there was a benefit for sodium fluoride, I would not be in favor of adding sodium fluoride. But I will tell you, were you faced with the decision of having to add fluoridation, from the toxics component from at least this one study, this study at least supports there'd be a benefit from using sodium fluoride.
May I follow up? Mr. Chair,
and
sodium fluoride is not pharmaceutical grade, or is it?
No,
it's not.
We've pushed this beyond.
I know, but Ms. Kaminsky has been sitting there waiting patiently. Can we please hear her?
Okay.
She's from out of time.
I need to go.
Okay, I just want to make a couple of points quickly because I appreciate the time, and thank you for letting us testify. I apologize if I seem a little disorganized because...
I need to go take a telephone.
That's fine.
I'm not
no problem.
Your testimony. My vice chair will take good care of making sure your testimony serves.
Okay, thank you. As we were discussing, and I wanted to address Representative Flores' concerns about the products that we are putting in, we know that these are not pharmaceutical grade. They are industrial waste products. They are contaminated with hazardous substances such as lead and arsenic that exceed EPA maximum contaminant level goals. The EPA has set maximum contaminant level goals that are protective of human health from lead and arsenic at zero. And these products that we're putting in our drinking water exceed those maximum contaminant level goals.
Ms. Kaminsky?
Yes.
Would you be able to provide that specific government documentation for the committee?
I would be happy to. Actually, isn't that it right there?
Is it a government document?
Yes. Furthermore, I'd like to add that these products that we're putting in the drinking water have never been FDA approved for the purpose of ingestion for the prevention of dental caries. Fluoride, when added to drinking water, is a drug that is regulated by the FDA. We have documentation that shows that as well. It is not a nutrient. It is not something that is essential for healthy dental benefits. We don't need fluoride in our diet in order to have good teeth. There are no studies that show that the long-term ingestion of these compounds is safe for human health. We absolutely have no data on that. Proponents of fluoridation don't dispute that these are toxic waste products. They don't dispute that the contaminants exceed maximum contaminant level goals set by EPA, and they are unable to produce any long-term scientific studies that show that these products are safe for human ingestion. I quickly wanted to address a point about the Harvard study. What was unique about the Harvard study is that Ms. Bassin looked only to children under the age of 20 years old, because when you look at an entire population and you're looking for bone cancer rates in an entire population, statistically the results are insignificant. But if you look only to children under the age of 20, the results of that study that showed that boys between the ages of 5 and 10 years old who drink fluoridated water at so-called optimally fluoridated levels are 500% more likely to develop osteosarcoma. What's significant of that is between the ages of 5 and 10 is when boys are going through the big growth spurts of the long bones, and that's usually where osteosarcoma forms during these growth spurt periods. I have a son who's 5 years old, and I'm very concerned about that study. And I think if there's any question about the safety of this product, which obviously there is, that we need to err on the side of caution. This is not something we should be mandating for every person in this state. This is mass medication. Fluoride is the only product that we add to our water to medicate people, and it's As Representative Bonamici pointed out, there's no control of the dosage. We're getting fluoride from many other sources, juices, pharmaceuticals, products like Stainmaster, 3M, anesthesias, pharmaceuticals, many, many other products. It's ubiquitous in our environment, and we have no idea what the background levels are. We're putting this out into the environment without having any idea how much fluoride people are already getting, and I have some very major concerns about that.
Missy, could you wrap up? Because I know some of us have to get back to Portland. I apologize, but it's after 5 o'clock.
Not a problem. I just want to conclude by saying that the National Research Council concluded that 4 parts per million, the EPA standard, is too high. People like to say that four parts per million is too high, but we're only fluoridating at 1 part per million. The difference between those two numbers are actually very quite small. There's a very small difference between 1 part per million and 4 parts per million. And if 4 parts per million is too high, we don't know what the safe dose is. And so until we know what that safe dose is, I don't think it's right to go charging forward and fluoridating our water at 1 part per million when we don't know when that's safe. And especially when members of the NRC panel said specifically that there are no safe levels for some members of our population that are most susceptible to the deleterious effects of fluoride, namely people with liver and kidney disease, children, infants, especially elderly, people with bone problems, people with diabetes, and people that have high water intake. So I'd like to thank the committee for hearing my testimony. Again, I apologize because we didn't have a whole lot of time and we didn't weren't told that we could actually testify. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Thank you.
You did fine, and thank you for your patience for staying this late. Final questions for the panel? With that, I will close the public hearing on, or the work session on House Bill 3099, and we're adjourned. See you.